One of my favorites. Speaking of a new drummer, this is probably something you're getting asked all the time. Why was Leonard Hayes dropped after the tour started?
Well, that was something that we decided to do because we were having some problems with him, and we felt that, you know, the band needed to go on in a positive way, and it was just getting to the point where the band was getting very depressed because things were not working out the way we wanted them to with him. And so, you know, we had to make a decision. Look, we either just stop playing altogether or, you know, get somebody to replace him and keep going. And obviously that was, you know, what we wanted to do. We never wanted to stop playing. So, I can't really get into specifics about why we let him go because I think it's, you know, in some ways it's better to just let things go and not, you know, for his sake. You know, I don't want to dog him or anything like that. I mean, he's a good guy. We love him. But some things happened that just didn't work out.
How did you find a new drummer so quickly?
It was tough. You know, I mean, basically, I got the word out to some of my fellow musicians out there. I mean, I started calling everybody I knew that I trusted that they would know some good drummers. I mean, I called, you know, let's see. I'm just trying to think of all the people that I called. Doug, the guitar player in Whitesnake, I called him. I called Jimmy DeGrasso. I called Mike Stone from Queensryche. I started literally just calling all kinds of people and saying, "Hey, you know anybody that might work really good for us?" You know, and then of course, you know, little by little, by word of mouth, some people started hearing about it. So within about 2 weeks, we had 17 names of drummers that you know came through our rehearsal studio. And we literally put it together. It was like from the moment I started calling people till the time we decided on somebody, it had to be done within 3 weeks because we had a European tour coming up, and we figured we need at least a week to rehearse with a new guy to come up with 20-something songs. So, you know, we had to do it fast. And like I said, it all happened within about 2 to 3 weeks.
And who is the new drummer?
His name's Mike Vanderhuel.
And did he... Has he played with any other bands?
He's just been in local bands mostly. He played in a band with the bass player in Tesla. I'm trying to remember the name of the band. I can't remember off the top of my head. But he's a student of Steve Smith, and he's a really good drummer, man. I mean, he's got a lot of chops, and he can groove for days. So it worked out pretty nicely.
What made you decide to remaster Black Tiger and Mean Streak at this point in time?
Well, you know, we've been asked for probably 20-something years, where can I find Earthshaker, Black Tiger, and Mean Streak, and In Rock We Trust, well, not In Rock We Trust, but those first three especially, on CD? Because when we were doing those records, of course, there were no CDs at the time. And when CDs finally came out in like 84 or so, A&M and their incredible wisdom decided not to go back into our roster and re-release those records in CD format. So our fans have been dying to get them, and me too, for so many years. The only way you could get it was as a Japanese import. So after years and years and years of constantly, you know, dickering with Universal Records, who now owns all of our back catalog, we finally got them to give us the rights to re-license and re-release them. So I thought the first thing we have to do is we have to go back in and, you know, get these things remastered and have them sound as good as they did while we were sitting in the studio hearing them mixed as they are now on CD. And so I knew what to do. We got the original analog, you know, two-track masters back, and, I went to the guy that I trusted do a really good job, and he did indeed. Between the two of us, we made that thing sound great.
Were the bonus tracks on those records, Somebody for Me and I'm So Sorry, were those written at the time those albums were recorded?
Actually, yeah, they were both written for the Black Tiger record, and those were the basic tracks for the Black Tiger record, meaning basically the drums, bass, and rhythm guitars, pre-mixed, already done, you know, with no vocals and no solo on it. And the reason that was done that way was we hadn't written the lyrics yet for like five or six songs as we were actually recording the record. So our engineer producer decided, well, I'll just do like a rough mix on a couple of these songs that they need to go over the lyrics, and I'll give them to Phil while Dave's singing the other songs, and Phil can write some lyrics while Dave's singing at the same time. And he never got around to finishing like two of those songs. So now, years later, that we know that we're going to re-release these records, we thought, let's go back in and, you know, rewrite the lyrics, brand new melodies, and put a solo over the top of this already mixed basic track. And that's how we did it.
One of my favorite songs of the band is also on Black Tiger, a tune called Winds of Change. Do you remember do you remember what the inspiration was for that song?
Really just sort of getting deep inside ourselves and thinking about, you know, things that were going on with our own life at the same time as sort of putting that idea forward to other people that we know in our life that have gone through, you know, changes and times that have been tough, and also, you know, a little bit of inspirational feelings at the same time, you know, thinking about how we got through tough times and how other people do as well and need to. And it was just me and Phil sitting down in his front room, I remember doing that, and listening to the basic track over and over and over again and really putting ourselves in the right state of mind to come up with a lyric like that. And that just happens to be one of my favorite songs to play live. And we will be doing that in Cleveland as well.
Oh, fantastic. Can't wait to hear that. One of the things that turned me on to the band was seeing the video for Mean Streak over and over in the early days of MTV. Do you think that early MTV play was really instrumental in breaking the band in the U.S.?
It probably helped a lot, yeah. As you know, when MTV first started, they didn't have that many videos to play. There weren't that many around, so bands were just starting to get hip to it. And whoever had videos the first year that MTV came out, man, they were played constantly. So yeah, it was a good timing for us, and a good song for us too as well to put in there, because that ended up making quite a bit of headway on American radio as well. So yeah, I mean, it definitely helped to make the biggest impact to get our ball rolling for at least the U.S. We'd already had pretty much almost become headline status by that time in Europe and in Japan, so the U.S. was lagging behind, and that helped to kick us.
How did the concept for that video come about?
I think that was a concept by the video director at that time. That was at a time when we were so young and new to video, as were so many other people, that, you know, we really didn't know what we were supposed to do, you know, and, you know, all we could think of was, well, we'll just play live in front of the camera. But of course, the video director had all these ideas about making it in a sort of haunted house looking vibe and sort of making it a dark kind of a thing. And, he did a pretty good job. So we just sort of rolled with them, thinking, well, they know better what they're doing probably. But of course, you know, they had a meeting with us before we shot it, and we went through the whole production and everything. But Phil's brother, who was working in film, doing special effects, he helped out, and he made like this like 20-foot snake tongue that comes out of the girl or something at one point.
Right.
So, yeah.
In 2003 and 2005, you released the Unearthed Volumes 1 and 2. What made you decide to assemble and release that older material at that time?
It all came from our website, actually, because we have a really active forum on our website, and the fans are there every day talking to each other from all over the world, and I go in there as well, and I respond to them, and it's a real nice atmosphere in there. And basically, what ended up happening is that, one of the fans had mentioned, hey, you know, so-and-so, some other band has done this kind of thing where, you know, they took all their previously unreleased material that they demoed up and never ended up getting on a record, and they put them on a record. We know that Y&T has tons of material over their course of their career. Why don't you guys do the same thing? And so, of course, that was as simple as that. I just read that, and I thought, yeah, we do have a lot of stuff. So, you know, I'll talk it over with the guys and see what they think. So we just started assembling stuff, you know. Everybody went through their cassette tapes and all of my little two tracks and anything that I had that had, you know, mixes of demos or whatever, you know. And I started assembling them. And as I put just, I probably got about halfway through the whole project, and we already had like 3 records worth of material, so it was like, yeah, this is going to be great.
Is that pretty much the case? Every time you record a record, there's always a lot of extra songs?
Yeah, and it really just depends. You know, when we were doing it full on in the 80s, we didn't have that many extra songs because they didn't give us that much time to write. You know, you just get off tour, and it's like, okay, you got like 2 months, come up with a record, and then we got to get you in to record, then we got to get you out on the road. So in 2 months' time, to come up with enough tunes that you feel are, you know, no filler tunes on a record, you got to write, you know, at that time you wrote like 8 to 10 songs for a record. You had to write like 12 to 14. So we didn't have that many extra on those necessarily, but earlier in our career, before we got something, we had a lot of songs. And then later on, when we decided, you know what, we're not going to do this 2 month thing anymore, let's take our time and really come up with, you know, the best stuff that we can without rushing through it. And that happened more in the Geffen days when we came out with Contagious and 10. And at that time also, there was a lot of home studio gear that was coming up, so I grabbed onto it, and I had a little 16-track studio at home, and so we were demoing everything that we were writing, and we probably wrote something like 35 extra songs for those 2 records alone.
Wow.
And demoed them completely, you know, written with lyrics and you know, done, and the demos, I mean, I made pretty good sound in demos, and that's what you're hearing on those records.